I'd like to just start off by saying that after the wonderful presentation, when we have our question and answer time, if you could please wait for the microphone, because I think in the past sessions, people have been just kind of shooting out questions. So please wait for the microphones, and we'll get it to you. I told Jennifer yesterday that she definitely wins for the most interesting topic for the conference. And there's actually a fixation here, because in your program it says the blind man, but she can't talk about just one man. She's got to talk about a few. So we're very curious as to how the blind men and the elephant, and how it all incorporates into this topic of service design and design of the world. If you could give a round of applause for Jennifer Leonard.
Thank you, Kippum. And thanks very much for actually making it possible for me to be here and for the invitation. It's a great event. I love that it's student run. And yes, it's true. This is the title of my talk, At Your Service, The Blind Man, the Elephant, and the Design of the World. So let me start by sharing with you a very old Indian legend. And it is about blind men and an elephant. And it was written by an American poet, John Godfrey Sachs, in the early 19th century. So this is the reason for the kind of language that you're about to hear. It was six men of Indistan, to learning much inclined, who went to see the elephant, though all of them were blind, that each by observation might satisfy his mind. The first approached the elephant, and happening to fall against his broad and sturdy side, at once began to bawl, "God bless me, but the elephant is very like a wall." The second, feeling the tusk, cried, "Ho, what have we here, so very round and smooth and sharp? To me, 'tis mighty clear, this wonder of an elephant is very like a spear." The third approached the animal, and happening to take the squirming trunk within his hands, thus boldly up and spake, "I see," quoth he, "the elephant is very like a snake." The fourth reached out an eager hand and felt about the knee. "What most this wondrous beast is like is mighty plain," quoth he. "'Tis clear enough the elephant is very like a tree." The fifth, who chanced to touch the ear, said, "Even the blindest man can tell what this resembles most. Deny the fact who can. This marvel of an elephant is very like a fan." The sixth no sooner had begun about the beast to grope, then seizing on the swinging tail that fell within his scope, "I see," quoth he, "the elephant is very like a rope." And so these men of Indistan disputed long and loud and long, each in his own opinion exceeding stiff and strong, though each was partly in the right and all were in the wrong. So I share this story with you today to kick off my talk and to drive home the importance of holistic thinking. So a few years ago, I just want to get this a little closer here. A few years ago, I co-authored this book called Massive Change. It was about the future of global design, and not about the world of design, but about the design of the world. And by that, we didn't look at the typical siloed design disciplines, graphic, typology, architecture, fashion. We really took aesthetics off the table entirely and endeavored to look at design, you know, as a multidisciplinary problem-solving methodology and practice, and applied it to all realms of human exchange. And we called these realms of exchanges economies. And so these were the ones that we set out to explore: urban movement, energy, and the list goes down. So when I was writing the book, I don't know how well you can make this out, but this is about a 3x5 foot piece of craft paper. And it was my first attempt at mapping out the content of the book. It was really a beginning of a table of contents. And you can see along the left vertical strip, there's just three-letter short form for the economy. So URB is urban. It's not very clear. It's kind of dark. But so down the left vertical column are the chapters, and each chapter going across has four themes. And within the themes, there are subjects. And within subjects, I started figuring out who are the people out there in the world who are visionaries in these areas, like on mobility, mass transit, or solar energy, or carbon nanotechnology. And I started a radio show and sought out these people, and I wanted to speak with them firsthand. So the content of the book derived from the radio interviews. But what's really interesting about this map, and you cannot see it at all, but I took a colored pen and started drawing the interconnections between the different topics. And I realized the interconnections then, but now I realize more importantly, it's not about design economies. This is not an inventory of technology. It's actually an interconnection map of human stories. And I like to call them not design economies anymore, but design ecologies. So that's my new moving forward. And so, for instance, the urban economy was actually about documenting a wave of new innovations in housing, shelter, urban space. It was about relaying the fact that urban sprawl, taking Rem Koolhaas's inspiration, is actually that all space, is now city, and that comes from Rem, and we must consider it as such. It was about green building technologies, it was about manufactured housing materials. But the urban ecology, how I see it now, is it's actually about the new urbanists. It's about those people out there who are guerrilla gardeners and green thumbs and people who are turning dead urban space into living, thriving ecosystems and breathing life back into it. It's made of people around the world who are changing their behaviors as well as their light bulbs. And they're seeking to make less of an imprint on the path they travel and the trail that they're leaving for others. Now, the movement economy was, I don't know where that slide went, but that's okay. The movement economy was about collecting evidence of, congested highways and different experiments in mobility from all corners of the globe and showcasing these vehicles and transporters like Segways and all experiments in renewable or entirely electric transportation innovations. But the movement ecology in this image actually is from Curitiba, Brazil, and it really is a mass transit ecology designed by Jamie Lerner, who was a former architect and, or still is an architect, but former mayor of the city. And it was about new ways of moving, but in relation to each other. And the new mobilists out there are, traveling in smart cars, they're on buses, they're on bikes, they're on trains, scooters, skateboards, whatever it is, they're walking and biking their way to understanding new ways of moving in relation to each other. The energy economy was about trying to understand what's being developed at both small and large scales. This is Three Gorges. And to technically respond to our shared global challenge, our energy challenge. It was about wind, solar, geothermal, biomass, hydroelectric, and coal. It was a landscape of all activity in electrification. But the energy ecology is about new energizers, new people experiments, the champions of fresh air blankets, wool socks, hand fans. They're cognizant of turning the lights off and powering down their PCs, switching over to CFLs. These folks are unafraid to use human power to get their motor running. And they know that this is in no way about giving up what we've got. It's about knowing there's so much more that we still can do with less for ourselves and for others. And on that note, I just want to show a quick little video from YouTube. And it comes from the Honeybee Network in India. And it's just a phenomenal organization. And actually, the Discovery Channel made these little commercials, and it's about non-designers, but just everyday people who are all across India, who, you know, necessity is a mother of invention. So these people who are just coming up with these radical technologies, they see a problem and they solve it. So here's a gal and her design.
ഇത് വളരെ ലളിതമാണ്. ഇത് ആകർഷകമായ ഒരു ഇലക്ട്രോണിക് ഉപകരണമല്ല. പക്ഷേ അച്ഛന്റെ കരണ്ട് ബിൽ കുറയ്ക്കുന്നു. പക്ഷേ എന്റെ ടീച്ചർ പറഞ്ഞിട്ടുണ്ട് ഈ ലോകം ഒരു പൊട്ടിത്തെറിയാണ് ഉണ്ടായിട്ടുള്ളത്.
So I urge you to check out more. There are a whole bunch of people who are inventing random everyday things. It's really inspiring. Okay. And the information economy was about information overload, grid computing, complex data mapping. The information ecology, however, is about the new informers, the citizen reporters all over the world. This is Oh My News, and do you know it? Okay. This is, it's in Seoul, actually. And they have 30,000 citizen reporters that are contributing to the news making. And it just makes for a very robust form of journalism, frankly. It's not top-down, it's very collaborative. So I'm not going to go through all the economies here and reflect on how they're more ecologies, but the market economy, for example, actually becomes a dynamic system of new marketers. This is a shot from the World Social Forum rather than the World Economic Forum. It happens in Brazil every year. And you know they're valuing quality of life over numbers and stats. So how does this all relate to service design? I believe the future of service actually is, it requires that we abandon this sort of fragmented view of the world and we start embracing holistic thinking, multidisciplinary research methods, and collaboration. Secondly, I believe the future of service is fueled by human stories. So let me share a few of my own, because believe me, I've had this motley crew of service experiences of late. I've hailed many a taxi, but one in particular, I got in recently and there was no meter, and then we got onto the Chicago freeway and he ran out of gas. So I very impetuously hopped out and hitchhiked and found my way back to safety, which probably isn't so safe, but I made it. That was strange. And then, because I'm located out of our Chicago office right now, my little Beetle back in San Francisco got towed. So I had the service experience of going into this place called Auto Return, whose little motto there says, "We care." But in fact, when I went in there, the gal behind the counter didn't care at all. At all. So there was no eye contact, there was no, "How you doing?" "Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry." Nothing. Just, you know, pay a lot of money and you can get your car back. And I actually got a tattoo recently, and that was an interesting service experience because it hurt like hell. And but I sought it out. And there was no kind of like user empathy from the tattoo artist for me. They were playing this hardcore music, and they were actually making fun of me. They were in the power position. I couldn't do anything. They had a needle in my back. And I also went for a massage. So this is something you want to do when you want to pamper yourself, of course, but unfortunately, it was one of those experiences where I didn't get a great therapist. Her hands were more like chopsticks, and they were oven mitts, so it hurt. But you go into this kind of a service to pamper yourself, to indulge, to walk out there feeling a lot better than when you go in. So these stories help form different kinds of service design typologies. And that, you know, it shows the many colors and flavors of service. and from an ecological perspective, the many species of service. So sometimes service means support, the everyday kinds of activities when you, you know, get your clothes laundered or get your house cleaned or you hail a taxi. And there are certain expectations from a customer when you seek out a support service. You know, you want it to be reliable and you want a good level of quality, but there's a lot of variation within that. You know, my particular taxi driver was not supportive, and you have to respond in the moment when something like that happens. Sometimes service means penalty, so that's about, you know, my car getting towed and having, because I broke the law, it was parked somewhere for too long, I had to seek out a service in which, you know, I had to pay to get out of it. And service also means risk. So these are the kinds of service experiences that we put ourselves at a certain level of risk. So yeah, you know, you get a tattoo, you go bungee jumping, or you go on a roller coaster, whatever they are. But there's a risk component. And the customer who seeks out these experiences goes in, hopefully eyes wide open, knowing that it may not be pleasurable, but it's something sought after. Service can also mean reward, and that is in the context of getting a massage. And again, there's variance within that. It's not always going to be rewarding. It depends on the human interaction and the luck of the draw. And the quality of service depends on a bunch of things. So it depends on responsibility. So again, going back to the support service, with a taxi driver, for example, you want to make sure that someone is responsible, you know, both from a deliverer of a service and a receiver of service. Service also depends on accountability, and that is you obey the law, and if you don't, you must be accountable. And service depends on vulnerability. We put ourselves into other people's hands literally sometimes. And service depends on our ability to give to ourselves, so when we want to treat ourselves. And again, there's no guarantee that it's going to be a treat. So when designing service, needs need to be assessed, expectations need to be checked, and context needs to be considered. So there are two more pieces of service that I'd like to add, which is leading me to away from the typologies and more towards service truism. Because I'm not a service expert by any means. I'm a service expert in the extent that we all are. We all experience and deliver service every day of our lives. But I'm thinking, how does this connect to the kind of work that I do and my thoughts around design and what it means in the world? So the truism for me around service design kind of relate to these last two stories, which I will share with you. And a train image here is on the screen, because my mom recently came down to Chicago to visit me, and before leaving, she realized that she had dropped her sweater somewhere, and we were in a hurry to get her to the train to get home, and so we didn't have time to retrace our steps. So we dropped her off, but I was really determined. I wanted to find that sweater, so I did retrace our steps, and I found her sweater, and it was sitting on a little outdoor cafe table. I looked at my watch, and it was 10 to 3, and her train was leaving Union Station at 3. And I thought, I can go back to my apartment and I can put the sweater in an envelope and put it in the mail on Monday. Or I can take on this big adventure and hop in a taxi myself and try to get to Union Station and try to get her. I was getting all excited, the adrenaline was flowing, so I did. I hopped in a taxi, and this time it was a good taxi driver who understood my needs. My needs were urgent needs. I was excited, but I wasn't angry. I was just like thrilled. I really wanted to get that sweater to my mom. And so luck would have it, the flow of the traffic in the city of Chicago was on my side. And we got to Union Station. And you know, I paid my taxi and I got in and I sprinted and I asked people inside, where's the Amtrak station and the tracks? And they pointed me and I was like sweating and I was out of breath. And I got to the Amtrak and I told my story. And it was like 2 minutes to 3. And this guy, this Amtrak employee, overheard me telling my story, like, please let me in, please let me in, I want to give this sweater to my mom. So he's like, come with me. We start sprinting, and we go to the track, the train's departing, it's starting to move, and he puts me on this motorized cart. We're like, back. We're like, it's like, I felt like I was in a movie. And we're driving along the platform, and the conductor's like hanging out and going, what the hell? And we toss the sweater at him. We're like, give this to Janet Leonard. She's going to, you know, Detroit, Michigan. And he's like, okay. And this was amazing. And just, you know, I'm telling this story because it shows that ultimately, you know, every single service experience, every touch point along the way from me leaving my apartment and making the decision to get there and give that sweater to my mom, so I was determined, depended on all the human encounters that I had along the way. That if I had the taxi driver that I originally had, you know, when I was on the freeway and he ran out of gas and didn't have a meter, I wouldn't have made it. And that guy who was working at Amtrak, who was overhearing me tell my story, if he didn't have that kind of sense of generosity within himself, wanting to help me, then I wouldn't have made it. And so it just goes back to this idea of interconnectivity and human stories and holistic thinking, and the whole service experience is made up of all those little steps along the way that made it a successful experience. And the next, so that one's about trust. It's about trusting others, putting your trust in others. And the second story, this is just a shot I took while I was waiting in the restaurant of the Sofitel Hotel in Chicago. I'm staying right now in a corporate apartment. I don't live there, but I am working and staying there right now. And it was very late one night, and I didn't have any groceries, and everything was closed. So I just wandered over to the hotel, and I had absolutely no expectations. And I asked the guy, the maitre d', can I, you know, look at the menu and maybe get something to go? And he's like, but of course. Come on in. And the level of service blew my mind. I was sitting there, I just ordered a risotto to go or something, but they brought me a glass of wine. They brought me an amuse-bouche, a little tuna tartare with a seaweed salad, and a salad. I was like, what is this? Like, this is attention to beyond my wildest expectation service. And so this was really about the ability for us to receive good service. So the first one was really about completely giving myself over and trusting other people. And this story was going in with absolutely no expectations and being completely blown away and delightfully surprised. So the first one's about trust, this one's about surprise. And so I think that service ultimately also means trust and surprise, and that connected to those two words, it depends on our ability to give to others, as well as our ability to receive from others. So service really is about give and take. It's not always about, you know, the customer is always right anymore. It's about a dialogue between people. And does anyone know the book by Alvin Toffler? You know, the Third Wave? He talked about the era, the third wave era, about the producing consumer. So yes, more and more we see it all the time, where consumers are producing more with the Nike ID and all these other great examples that we heard yesterday. But I endeavor to say that there are also consuming producers. And just like I was saying, I'm not a service expert, but I live service every day. I give it and I receive it. So we have prosumers, but we also have conducers, which is a new word I just made up. So service really, ultimately, I think at the heart of it, if we're just gonna strip everything bare and say, what is it about for me? It's about our ability to give to others and our ability to receive from others. And Bill Clinton has a new book out, and he writes, it's called Giving. And in it, he writes about how each of us can change the world. And this is a quote. He says, "We all have the capacity to do great things. My hope is that the people and stories in this book will lift spirits, touch hearts, and demonstrate that citizen activism and service can be a powerful agent of change in the world." So service design is a complex organism, like an elephant, like anything living for that matter. And we can't understand its entirety by examining only its fragments. We can only begin to better understand service by examining its fragments in relationship to the whole. And that's where I come full circle. And I left a lot of time for questions, so thank you. Do we have any questions?
This is going to be a long-winded question. I hope you can bear with me. First of all, I'm an architect, so I come from another discipline. My notion of service design when I first thought about it was that this was something like a sub-discipline in design, that just like industrial design and graphic design, you know, service design attends to linking what designers do to the consumer, to the client. But I think I realized in the course of 2 days that this is much more than that. This is design field, looking at all consumers and looking at all products that may be produced by other disciplines and other professionals, and wants to make those things compatible. So this is almost like a meta discipline that, you know, it's like a universal joint between the client and all things that are produced. What audacity! please, you know, forgive me for saying that as not being from the profession, but I think there's a great ambition and a you know, great idea here that design could do this. The obstacles that I see is that some disciplines have already done this. For instance, architecture has been in the business of participatory design for about 50 years, and the advantage they have over somebody else coming in and making it serviceable, so to speak, is that they built in the design into the design process, the client's participation, so that it's a product that's not sold to the client. It's a product that the client actually participates in producing. So given these kinds of sort of, forgive me for asking such a large question, do you see that service design is going to be something that can actually be accepted by all the disciplines as this sort of universal joint that they would be happy to participate in?
Now, when you say accepted by all the disciplines, are you talking about within design, or are you talking about within life and all the careers that are possible?
I mean, the examples I've seen go all the way from tattoos to to urban environments and everything else in between. So
yeah.
I mean all of those things.
Yeah.
Medicine, law, I mean, you name it. I think there's an ambition here for design to go into any business circumstance and be the joint or the connector between that discipline and the consumer. Do you think this is a realistic ambition? And if not, how should it be possible that this can happen?
Where do I begin? No, that's fantastic. I think you are really just summarizing quite nicely where I was going and what I was trying to communicate. Because I come from outside of design into design. I was a journalist for 12 years before I decided to go design. And I just so happened upon a kind of design research that was almost like activism, humanitarianism. And it was beautiful for me at the time, because that's why I went into journalism. And it didn't prove to be enough for me. I was always at an arm's reach from the content, and I thought by getting into design, I could get my hands into the content and actually make a change. But the point is that it's not limited to design itself, or those who call themselves designers, and that's what I was trying to get at in the Massive Change Project, in having that radio show where I interviewed Nobel Prize winning chemists, and I interviewed physicists, and I interviewed economists, and I interviewed all different kinds of disciplines, and just asked, you know, what problems do you see right now in the world that we share, and how can you think about that problem from your area of expertise and apply your skills and your creativity to it to help solve it, and how can you work with other disciplines to do the same thing? And I think that is at the heart of design, and That's why design is kind of like busting up and going through its own redesign at the moment. And we're living in a world where the problems are very, very vivid in front of our eyes, because we can see all corners of the globe if we choose to. And we have the technology right now at our disposal to apply to these problems, but it's ultimately about human relationships and the decisions we make on how to do what we do and how to apply the technology that we have. So service design running through all that, then, looking at the same sort of very broad lens, is about how we give and receive to each other. And that might make some service design experts uncomfortable because it's too broad, but I think that that's what I bring to the conversation, is that very, very broad outlook on service. You know, it's a discipline, absolutely, but it's also a way of life.
Hi, thanks for your talk. It was really stimulating. You talked about service design in the beginning. You also talked about individuals planting gardens. You talked about the taxi driver and your massage therapist. But you didn't really talk about Amtrak. You didn't talk about the massage center or the spa. What kinds of implications do these stories have for organizations? And how can you tie it back to the ecological relationship you talked about in the beginning of your talk?
What kind of implications do the stories have with organizations?
Like,
well, again, because the kind of design now that I do is first human and then learning from how humans interact with one another, get inspired by that, find patterns with that, and apply new learnings to help support behavioral change so that the world's a better place, right? So by telling more of these stories and engaging people, I think there's great power in storytelling. How we look at the world is reflective in how we talk about the world, and vice versa. And so if we're telling more stories where we have our own personal service experiences that were good, bad, somewhere in between, and a business chooses to listen, then I think that level of service and customer satisfaction can be greatly improved. And when that sort of interest and open-mindedness is at play within the business context, the brand will have a new life to it as well. But it's happening more and more and more. You know, Business Week magazine is always talking about design and innovation, and different firms different businesses who are starting to think like designers. I mean, that's a lot of what we do at IDEO. Right, Mark? Wake up! and a lot of what a lot of companies are doing, and I think the more the merrier. It shouldn't be about competition, it should be about collaboration. So that's how I think it relates to business. And then how does it relate to an ecological perspective? Well, that really is how I was saying, I like to call them design ecologies now, not design economies, because we are, every area, every subject matter comes to life by way of things that are alive running through it. Human beings are the organisms in companies, and we are nature, and we make decisions and choices, and we choose to give or receive or not. And in every moment, I mean, so it's a dynamic system. Even though it's a business or it's design, it's all made up of people, and we're living and breathing systems. So that's how I'm trying to think of, you know, how can we look at service design as an ecology? Well, it's all of those things that I said. Does that make any sense? Okay.
I want to follow up on Jody's comment too, because is your experience with Amtrak, is that about Amtrak, or is that about those individuals who you encountered?
Well, I think those, you may have more to ask?
Yeah,
okay.
And depending on how you answer that, how can we, as people who want to be service designers or are service designers, how can we design an Amtrak that's always like that? How how can you move past that individualistic experience to move to a company, to an organization?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so is my Amtrak experience about Amtrak? Yes, because I associate that wonderful generosity of an Amtrak employee with Amtrak now. Of course, not every single employee would have responded the same way, or maybe I'll never have that kind of experience with Amtrak again. But I have the memory implanted of that wonderful experience. And so when I think of Amtrak, I think of that story. And so it does positively infuse over the brand, over the company. And then what was the second part? How do you, as service designers, well, you take to heart those kinds of stories that people tell, the good, the bad, the ugly, about a company. And you call those stories together, and you kind of do a balance. You're like, hey, where are these stories falling? Are they falling in the sort of fantastic, best experience I've ever had in my life category? Or is that really missing a lot of that juice and goodness? So you pay attention to people, and you pay attention to user needs, and you try to reinforce those pieces that are part of the positive stories. And so you keep your ears open, you listen a heck of a lot, and you care. You ultimately have to be engaged and pay attention every single day. I mean, whether you walk into the office and you're at work and you start service design, or you are out in the world, and you're always looking for little instances that can inspire you in your work.
That was really great talk, thank you.
Thank you.
I want to follow up on Jody's question as well. I really like the words that you used, humanity, empathy, and I think what we're talking about is limbic system over cognitive function, right? And the experiences that you described all were affect. There wasn't anything really designed for you to cogitate on and appreciate. So there were, you used the word surprise. That was a chemical impulse that wasn't designed by some designer. It was your expectations were exceeded by the humanity of somebody, not by the design. I think that's the question, is how do you, we've heard a lot about system designs and balls and sticks and flows and processes, and what you've brought to light is the real delight in the service comes from affect. And how do you bring affect into design? How do you meld those two worlds? I think that's the hard question.
Yeah. Well, I love Jane Jacobs. Do you know Jane Jacobs?
No.
She, I think she passed away. She wonderful landscape designer, urban visionary. And her really simple definition of design is people. And I think that that's where I stand. And so, even though the experience, say at the hotel, when I was ordering food and was brought all these delights that I hadn't anticipated, it was a person who made the decision to go over and above any kind of manual that said this is how we interact with our customers.
Right, and I guess that's the hard part that we're dealing with here, is because facial expression was read by you in 50 milliseconds. And you had a response to that. That wasn't orchestrated by any designer.
Mm-hmm. Well,
can we bring that? When we had some presentations of healthcare systems where you're interacting with maybe a person, but you're not reading facial expression, maybe you're reading tone. There's a lot lost in a lot of what we design. is it possible, do you think, to bring humanity
into design?
Well, into these really complex systems.
Complex systems are made up of people, are they not?
Right.
But right.
When you look at most of our designs, they're machines talking to machines, person in the center. And
yeah.
Very, very, you start losing a lot of human interaction.
Yeah. Yes. And so, you're right. And I'm thinking about what to say about that. I mean, more and more, I hope at least, people are looking from a human-centric and not tech-centric perspective. But yes, technology is becoming more intelligent all the time, and pieces of technology are communicating with each other. And people ultimately are the ones that program that technology. Can we, maybe the bigger question then is, can we program humanity into technology? Can we program compassion into technology? Can we program empathy into technology? Maybe. That's not my realm of, probably a lot of people at MIT are thinking about this, at least I hope they are. I don't know what else to say. It's a really big question. Thanks.
Well, it's a, maybe it's more of a comment on that last point, right? And it's really, the technology is just supposed to support the humans in doing it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that if a human has, you know, empathy 2, the technology allows them to project empathy 10 through some, you know, acceleration through the infrastructure that they have to spread out that empathy, right? Make it more powerful,
mm-hmm.
because of the, you know, the bar and the nice wine glasses and the, you know, the system that allows them to order your salad from the kitchen, et cetera, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so technology can only go a certain distance, and then in the end, I mean, you said this 5 minutes ago, the humans are the ones who are going to provide the service, right? And the technology
yeah.
just provides as much of the support as is reasonable,
yeah.
right? It doesn't have to become some AI thing where, you know, the computer
right,
can
right.
grab your sweater and run down the track.
Wouldn't that be nice? But no, it wouldn't be nice. I mean, maybe. But but the story that is so fun to tell wouldn't be here. I had a robot run down the track with the sweater that my mom ultimately did get. But yes, technology is neither good nor evil. It is how we use it and how we design it so that it supports better human interactions. Yes.
Talking about people and design for people, designing technology systems for providers, are we really talking here, are we really saying service design is designing those people's behavior, designing the taxi driver's attitude toward you, designing the taxi itself, or all the technology systems involved in that taxi, or systems to enable that taxi driver to provide better service?
It's complex, isn't it?
Well, that
service.
Actually
yeah.
wouldn't really do it for you. What you
yeah.
need to actually design is attitude and the smile and his personality to be delightful.
Mm-hmm.
How do we do that?
Well, let me share a story with you, and which is a great note to end on. So I think we do we have to wrap? Kip? Yeah. Okay. One of my design heroes. His name. Well, he's not a designer, but he's one of my design heroes. His name is Antanas Mokas, and he was a mathematician, philosopher. Who went into politics. He became the mayor of Bogota, Colombia, for a while. And Bogota was on the edge of chaos when he became mayor, and he wanted to apply some of his understandings of what motivated human behavioral change because of mathematics and philosophy, and apply it to the streets and apply it to the problems and see what he came up with. And just this guy is so phenomenal and so playful and fun. So one of the things, we're talking about taxis, he did is he started this group called Knights of the Zebra. And he, all of the taxi drivers of Bogota, Colombia, who were nominated by the people as having good attitudes, were benighted. they became part of this Knights of the Zebra. And he called them in to his office. And, well, first he asked the citizens, call me with the names, you know, and then he got the contact information for all the taxi drivers. And he said, okay, listen, you're here today because you're going to be part of this group called Knights of the Zebra, and it means nothing other than you're a member of the Knights of the Zebra. And what I want you to do right now with me is have a brainstorm on how we can change the attitudes of every taxi driver that's not here. And so he did. And he did all these amazing other little experiments, like there were traffic problems, and he hired mimes to go out in the street and make fun of people and follow them when they weren't obeying the rule. Because no one wants to be made fun of by a mime. And so it worked. He had these outrageous ideas, but he got at what, you know, what would make people want to change, and he had fun with it, and he empowered the citizens. And because they had an investment in the success of their country, their city, positive change really did come about. Things were changed. Antanas, A-N-T-A-N-A-S, Mokas, M-O-C-K-U-S. He was Lithuanian-Colombian. Wonderful guy. I hope he goes. I think last I heard he might be running for presidency of Colombia. I hope he. That would be fantastic. Are you? Oh, yay! Yeah. Yes, we're coming back to the elephant. Great. Thank you so much.
Everyone, we will reconvene at 2. If you notice in your schedule, it's different from yesterday. Yesterday we came back by 2:30, but if you can come back by 2, that'd be great. I don't know about this, but...